Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Backcountry in Des Moines, a boutique that believes, as Twain said, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. Located at 2702 Beaver Avenue, Backcountry curates clothing and gear for people who travel in mind now and in person soon.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. Richard Geron is going to join us in a few minutes to answer your questions. But we're going to start the hour with some strange bumps or growths that show up on tree branches or leaves. They are called galls. And Donald Lewis, professor of entomology at Iowa State University, is here to help us unlock the mystery of these fascinating abnormal plant growths. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity. Glad to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And all right, let's talk about these bumps. They come in many different varieties. So what do we normally see when we're seeing a gall?
A gall is an abnormal growth, but it is distinctive. It's not just something random. Often you'll see more than one on a plant, but galls are these growths that form on the leaves, on the stems, on the roots. Actually, they're pretty common. Galls, these growths can be caused by mechanical injury. They can be caused by pathogens or viruses. But the ones that we normally think about are caused by insects and mites. So an insect or a mite attacked the leaf or the stem at the time of development, and then the plant created, out of its own cells, it created this wart or this bump or this lump or this swelling, all different shapes and sizes, all different configurations.
All right. So when people see them, sometimes if they're not familiar already with them, they freak out a little bit. How much freaking out is warranted when you see a gall?
Little to none. There's no real harm to the tree most of the time. Now, we have a couple of galls that will sort of take over a tree, and the tree becomes so ugly, it becomes like the orange carpet in your living room. It's still useful, but you no longer want to look at it. So there are some trees that become terribly disfigured. What many people see are leaves that turn brown or even leaves that drop as a result of the gall formation. And when leaves are dropping off your tree prematurely, sometimes that becomes alarming. And you say, wow, there's a lot of leaves on the ground. What can I do about it? What can I spray? And the answer is, don't freak out. Don't spray. There's nothing you can do at that point.
Does it damage the plant? Does it hurt it?
Whoa, hurting a plant, that sounds like a pretty deep topic to get into.
Okay, I'm not talking about physical pain. I'm talking about the health of the plant.
The damage to the plant. On occasion, there can be so much leaf drop that the tree will be stressed. There are some stem galls that deform the growth of the tree, and that can be concerning to the overall health and vigor. But for the vast majority of the galls on trees and shrubs, no, it's cosmetic. It deformed the leaves for a brief period of time. Those leaves either survived with it or they fell off because of it. So most of the time, it's just annoying or disfiguring. It's not damaging to the overall health and vigor.
All right, let's talk about these insects, because, of course, that's your area of study. Tell me about the insects or the mites that cause these galls. What do we know?
They are very specific. We're not talking about insects in general. We're talking about a very specific type of insect, and the insect is very particular for which plant it will attack. So we have these little tiny non-stinging wasps that if you even saw one, you would pass it off as some sort of a gnat. They're just so small. But these tiny wasps are commonly found in making galls. There's a huge number of midges, and midge is an all-purpose term for little tiny fly. There are midges that are specific to plants and cause galls on plants. And then there's a few other groups like aphids and psyllids, and there's a few different kinds of mites, but it's a really kind of a diverse group that have this coevolution with the plant so that the plant makes a protective container, a protective growth for the development of the insect's offspring.
All right. And so there are eggs inside these galls?
Yes. It often starts with an egg, although it can start with the individual insect. But this all happens at a very specific point in time. This doesn't happen throughout the summer. This happens in the springtime as the leaf is unfurling from the bud, that the cells inside that leaf bud that were destined to be leaf are hijacked. And those cells are hijacked because of the presence of this gall maker, and frequently it's the eggs of the gall maker that were laid into that tissue. So the chemical makeup of the cell is changed because of the presence of the alien body inside the plant, and those cells then grow into this wart or bump or growth, whatever it is, and include the insect inside. Sometimes there's only one insect inside a gall. Sometimes there are dozens, and with some of the aphid galls, it looks like there can be hundreds inside this growth on the leaf or on the petiole of the leaf. So it's a little bit variable, but yes, it starts with the invasion of the tissue by the gall maker insect itself.
Sounds like dissecting one of these would be a great science experiment in the spring or the summer.
It's kind of fun. For many of the woody ones, you chop and you chop and you whittle away, and you finally find this one little kernel at the middle where the insect is developing, that there's a lot of gall for one little insect. The best one to do this to is early in the season, if you can find a hickory tree. There's a gall on the petiole of hickory, and it's a swelling about the size of a dime. And you cut that open, and it's just teeming inside with these little tiny aphids that are feeding on sap from the tree from the inside of the gall. So cutting them open is kind of a fun thing to do, although sometimes it's fairly frustrating. The thing to remember is we are looking at part of the plant. The gall was made by the plant. We're not looking at parts of insects at that point. We're looking at cells of the plant that deform during their growth period.
That's fascinating. So we've been very general talking about galls. How many different kinds are there?
You know, I debate whether to say thousands or tens of thousands of different kind of galls. I did look this up just to see, and just among the wasps, we have at least 750 species of gallmaker wasps in the United States. We have 1,000 species of these midges in the United States, and then we have the psyllids and the aphids that we talked about. It just goes on, and these are just the ones we know about. These are the ones that have been identified, and we have figured out who they are and where they are and so forth. So it's at least thousands, if not tens of thousands, of these abnormal growths are caused by insects. So it's been a very successful strategy that has been repeated many times over by insects, finding a place that they can create a shelter. They let the plant create the shelter for them, and then that's how they reproduce.
And do all of the insects, are they specific to one kind of plant or tree that they have evolved to take advantage of?
Yes, and it's a particular insect attacks a specific tree at a specific point in time, and then the plant creates a unique and distinctive gall. So the wasp that makes the oak apple, the large gall that we see on oak trees at this time of the year, is only on bur oaks. And in fact, there's another similar gall on pin oaks called the succulent oak gall that is caused by a different species of wasp, even though the galls look a little bit similar. So it just goes on and on with this variety of how this is done. But yes, there is a different species of insect for each different kind of gall, which is just amazing.
Yeah, that is really incredible. So you mentioned the hickory, you mentioned the oak. We have 20 seconds left. Are there any other common ones that we should keep our eyes open for?
The maple bladder gall on the red bumps on the top of your silver maple leaves is a fairly obvious one. The bullet gall on oak stems is an obvious one that people will see. And then one of my favorites is the hackberry nipple gall. It looks like little nipples on the underside of hackberry leaves. For years, that's how I was able to identify that it was a hackberry tree.
All right. Well, I will keep my eyes open. Donald Lewis, thank you so much. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Donald Lewis, professor of entomology at Iowa State University, and Richard Giron is also here, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you both for being here, and we've already got so many people with questions. We'll dive right in. You can call us with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Patricia in Dallas County says, our neighbor has juniper bushes growing on the lot line between us. I would like to locate a new perennial bed on our side with the juniper as a backdrop. Is this a bad idea? If it's not a bad idea, what would be the minimum amount of space I should allow between the bushes, drip line, and our adjacent border edge?
That shouldn't be an issue as long as the plant is adapted to the site. Is it shady? Is it sunny? And how big is that juniper going to get? I'm assuming it's probably a landscape type, which is probably limited in the size, and just plant accordingly.
All right, and let's go to the phones. Jeffrey is on the line in Stone City. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
I have a 3-year-old Concord grape vines, 4 plants. They're showing signs of stress. The leaves are crinkling up and maybe some sort of a scaly substance on the vine itself. Also, I've got a question about my blackberry bushes.
All right. Well, let's start with that grapevine. What do you think?
Donald, could that
I'm
be
letting
an
Richard
insect?
Take the lead.
Okay.
Well.
Let's just toss that ball back and forth.
My first thought would be, as curling is concerned, could that be an insect? Possibly. Sometimes there are insects that will cause curling of the foliage. Another thought would be, well, could that be herbicide damage? Grapes are very sensitive to broadleaf herbicides like 2,4-D dicamba, and that will definitely cause curling of the leaves. So that's a possibility, too.
All right. So now you're tossing the ball back to Donald?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Yeah. The common insect on grapes causes little starburst-like growths on the underside. It's called the grape phylloxera gall. It's one like we were talking about earlier in the program. But that will cause the leaves to curl up and deform. But the growth, this little wart-like growth on the bottom side of the leaf, should be very apparent if that were the cause. Otherwise, things like aphids would be fairly spotty. The reason I threw it back to Richard to begin with is because my first guess was also going to be herbicide injury. But look it over for insects and see if they're there. Of course, all the other problems like planted too deeply, damage to the lower stems, all those are possibilities that you can look at and see what you can find.
All right. Jeffrey, you said you also had another question?
Yeah. Somebody told me once that I could put a weak Epsom salt mixture with water on my blackberries to promote additional blooming. I wondered about that because it is sort of a salt.
That's highly unlikely. No, I doubt that. The problem that we have with blackberries in Iowa is that they tend not to be very hardy, cold hardy. And so during the winter months, oftentimes we get severe dieback, and that destroys parts of the cane and the flowers, and so they don't produce very many fruit. So it's basically a cold hardiness issue. Epsom salt is used for various things. Many are basically bogus. They don't really do any good. So I wouldn't apply it.
All right. But you don't think that that's what did the damage?
No.
All right. But a waste of time, perhaps.
It's a waste of time.
All right. Jeffrey, thanks so much for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Stephen is on the line next. Hello, Stephen.
Hello. Yes, I was wondering if it's a good thing to cut the flowers off of potatoes as they're growing to help to make the potato itself, cut the flower off the potato plant to help make the potato grow itself.
No, there's no need to. That typically most varieties, they flower, but the flowers typically dry up and fall off. They don't set fruit, so there's no need to. There's only one variety that typically produces fruit to a great degree, and that is Yukon Gold. And they form these kind of marble-shaped fruit that look just like a miniature tomato, but they're the potato fruit. But they really don't take that much energy from the plant, so don't worry about it.
Okay, very well. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Stephen. Next up, Joanne in Coal Valley, Illinois. Hello, Joanne.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I'm talking about hydrangea plants.
Okay.
They have stopped blooming. I have a blossom on one, and last year there were three. I have two different ones, one pink and one blue. And I'm wondering if I should cut them all the way back in the fall or the spring or just the dead ones. And I know there are different kinds of hydrangea.
Yeah, there are different kinds, and that's the key. You have the smooth hydrangeas, you have the panicle hydrangeas, and you have the big leaf hydrangeas. And what you have are the big leaf hydrangeas, and there are many, many varieties, but they tend to bloom very, very sporadically. They're not reliable in many cases as far as blooming. That's unfortunate, but that's their history. As far as pruning, some of these bloom on old wood, some on new wood, some on both old wood and new wood. So what I would do in the spring is let the plant leaf out, okay? Then at that point, cut out all the dead wood. And that's basically it.
Well, thank you very much. What about rhubarb? Is it long-lived?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you can see rhubarb that's been there 50, 60 years. If it has a good site, it's very long-lived.
All right, Joanne, thank you so much for your call. You can join us, 866-780-9100 is the number to call. With me, Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, and Donald Lewis, Professor of Entomology at Iowa State University. So you can call with your plant or insect questions today, 866-780-9100, or send an email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Here's a question from Steve. He says, I grow a small variety of plants in 5-gallon containers on my back porch. I'm in an apartment, so I can't plant in the ground. This year, I decided to grow eggplant, and I'm having some problems with it. The leaves wilt badly in the sun. I understand that this is usually because of underwatering. My plants are on a drip irrigation line that flows at the rate of 0.5 gallon per hour. This has been sufficient for my tomatoes, all of which are further along than the eggplant. The soil is moist to the touch, but not heavily saturated. This does not happen on overcast days. It seems to be the result of being in direct sunlight. Everything I've read says that eggplant should be in full sun for at least 6 hours a day. What's going wrong?
I wonder if the soil might be kept too wet, being kept too wet. And if that's the case, then the plants may not have a very deep root system. And so on those sunny days, they're losing water at a faster rate than their small root system can absorb water. And so they tend to basically wilt. So I'm guessing it may be a water issue, and I would try to water less often.
Okay, so and the tomatoes should need more water than eggplant, do you think?
Well, I think they can tolerate it more so.
Okay, so he could probably dial it back on the tomatoes, too?
Probably, yes.
All right, good luck with that. Thanks for your question. This one's from Haley. I bought a Peruvian lily at a local box store. Is this a perennial in Zone 5, or will I need to dig it up in the fall?
I would treat it as an annual.
Okay.
So, that's what I would do.
Right, if she, you're saying digging it up in the fall is probably not worth her time.
Right.
Okay. All right. Just clarifying there. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Mary is on the line in Johnston. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Do you want my question?
Yes, I do.
Okay. I have two stems of roses that I got from my grandfather's farm probably 30 years ago, and they never grow more than just this one little stem. And what can I do to get them to be bigger? They're just these two little lonely stems.
Huh.
Okay. How big do they get? Do they flower?
I have, a couple years ago, I've seen flowers a time or two. The stem itself is not more than maybe half an inch, ever.
But how tall does it get?
What? How tall?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 2 or 3 feet.
Okay.
Should I cut them back somewhere?
Well, what I would probably do is cut them back in late March, early April.
Uh-huh.
And I would cut them back to maybe 4 or 5, 6 inches from the ground.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I hadn't done that. I've been very careful to not lose them from the deer or whatever. But mm-hmm. I wondered, okay.
But that should force some growth at the base. You're basically
uh-huh.
forcing some buds to break and grow from the base.
Okay. I'll do that.
All right. Good luck, Mary. Thanks a lot for your call. Here's a question from Liz for you, Donald. Some insect is eating my kale. There are circular holes and in some cases just the rib of the leaf remains. Any recommendations?
Well, I think the recommendation is to camp in the garden at night to see if you can figure out who's doing that. For the wholesale damage where all of the leaf is gone, I would suspect rabbits as a possibility. But among the caterpillars, there's one called the cabbage looper and one called the cabbage worm. It's the familiar white butterfly. Those you should be able to see on the leaf. If it was the cabbage worm or the cabbage looper, you should be able to turn over the leaf, look around, and find the caterpillar chewing at the edges, making the holes. Holes in the middle of the leaf also suggests maybe cutworms from earlier in the season. So not real sure what all is going on, and it may be more than one thing. So more investigation, more looking for the culprit. And if you do find caterpillars, you've got a great control with the Bacillus thuringiensis insecticide. This is non-toxic to people and pets, but it's toxic to caterpillars that feed on it. So if you do find caterpillars, that's what I would suggest, if it's more than what you can pick off by hand. But first, I would look around and see if you can find anybody, and if not, insecticide probably won't make any difference.
And if it's rabbits, a fence is a good idea, right?
It's yeah,
outside the entomologist's wheelhouse, but...
You know, not enough legs to qualify for an entomology answer, but I can speak from experience. I've got a lot of little cages around individual hostas in my yard because the adorable, cute little baby rabbits that have just appeared are hungry, and we have to keep them away from the plants we would love.
All right. Thanks so much for your question, Liz. Good luck with that. Joe's on the line next in Fredericksburg. Hi, Joe.
Good morning. We have 4 sunburst locust trees in our yard, and none of them have leaves over the top. Oh, maybe 10th or quarter of the branches. They're just quite bare, and I wondered what that is or what we could do about it.
Well, I'm not sure exactly. I would say that sunburst variety is not as vigorous as the normal green-leafed trees, so there's mm-hmm. some issues there. But I've also noticed this year that some of the honey locust trees have not leafed out as well as they normally do. And I'm thinking that may be to the weather. We didn't have a particularly cold winter, but we had some events that were rather different. We had extreme cold in mid-November, and we also had very cold temperatures in April. And at those times of year, trees are not as cold hardy as they are in midwinter. So those temperatures may have damaged trees to some extent. But I think it's also a variety thing. That variety is just not as vigorous as many other varieties, and we tend to see cankers and other problems in that tree.
All right. Well, Joe, thank you so much for your call. We are going to have to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes. You're listening to Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me today, Donald Lewis, professor of entomology at Iowa State University, and Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. You can join the conversation. Give us a call, 866-780-9100, or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Backcountry in Des Moines, a boutique that believes, as Twain said, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. Located at 2702 Beaver Avenue, Backcountry curates clothing and gear for people who travel in mind now and in person soon.
It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'm here this hour with Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, and Donald Lewis, Professor of Entomology at Iowa State University. They are here to answer your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Let's get to the phones. Nancy is on the line in Mount Vernon. Hi, Nancy.
Hi.
What's your question?
So I purchased two plants, and they're called miscanthus. And it's not miss, like M-I-S-S. It's a grass, mm-hmm. and the leaves are fairly sharp. It almost looks like it has a stripe in it. I'm worried that it may be an invasive species. Is it okay to plant?
There are some that are quite invasive. What you see in the roadside ditches, it's very common in basically late summer, kind of those silvery plumes on grasses in the ditch, and you'll see this big clump, very dense clump. That is a type of miscanthus. That is definitely a weed. It definitely is. Some of the other ones, some of the cultivated ones, can also come up from seed. Now, you do have a good alternative. There are some very, very good cultivars of our native grasses. For example, switchgrass. There are a number of cultivars of that which are very, very suitable for the landscape, like Northwind, which is a very common one. So there are cultivars of switchgrass, Indian grass, a little blue stem, big blue stem, and these are cultivars that may have some very special attribute, but they're also a cultivar of a native grass, and so they do fine.
Okay, so it sounds like you're recommending she not buy the miscanthus that she sees at the grocery store, but look elsewhere.
I would go with the native ones. I would.
All right. Nancy, thanks so much for your call. Sally's on the line next in Preston. Hi, Sally.
Hello. I have two questions about fruit trees. Number one, we're picking cherries off our cherry tree, and it seems like the leaves are very sparse. They're kind of yellow, kind of dropping off, and there is also a white fungus, like, on the trunk. I was wondering if there's anything we should be doing about that or what we can do about that. And we also have a Honeycrisp that has had no blossoms for 3 years. We planted it 3 years ago. It gets leaves, but it doesn't blossom. And we do have another apple tree, a Liberty, but I don't know what we're doing wrong with this Honeycrisp.
Well, I'll start with the Honeycrisp. That's a very popular apple as far as the fruit, but the tree is kind of finicky. It's kind of difficult to grow, even for commercial growers. Now, as far as when you plant an apple tree, oftentimes they will not flower for maybe 3 or 4 years. So that's fairly common. So they should start bearing fruit, hopefully, I would say, maybe in 5 years. That would be fairly average. As far as the cherry tree, if there's actually a white growth that kind of sticks out from the actual trunk,
yeah, so it was kind of like a shelf type stuff.
Okay.
A fungus type, you know.
Well, there's two things that come to mind. Lichens are very, very common on the trunks of trees, and these are kind of grayish or kind of grayish-green in color, but they're very, very flat, and they adhere very tightly to the trunk. They're not a problem.
But this fungus stands out from the trunk, and it's white.
Okay, so that would suggest it's a wood decay type fungus, that apparently a portion of the trunk has died, And now you have a wood decay fungus which has invaded that area and is producing this growth.
Okay.
So apparently a part of the trunk has died. Now, cherry trees tend to be fairly short-lived in Iowa. I would say 15, 20 years would be average. So this tree apparently has some trunk damage, and I would assume over time that the tree may eventually decline and die. But that may be 5 years, maybe 10 years in the future. But there is probably some dieback in the trunk.
Mm-hmm. I noticed one branch, a good-sized branch on the tree is dead, had no leaves or anything. So obviously that's what it was. There's nothing we can do then as far as this loss of leaves. That's not something I should be concerned about then.
That could be maybe a leaf-type disease. They do get like a leaf spot, which may cause some of the leaves to yellow and fall off. You really can't do much about that, and you really can't do much about the damage to the trunk. But I would definitely prune out the dead branch in the tree.
All right, Sally, thanks so much for your call. Here's a question about your favorite topic, Donald, Japanese beetles. Martha in Iowa County says, I have found two beetles in the last 2 days, one on a Shasta daisy and one on a bean leaf. Suggestions for killing them? So first of all, Donald, when do we normally see the Japanese beetles show up, and are you getting calls about them?
We actually pay attention to this, and June 20th is when we expect to see the first one. And this year, they might have been a little bit late, but they were on time. So we're starting to get reports of Japanese beetles. But the interesting thing is, like Martha's response, so far people can count their Japanese beetles on one hand.
That's great.
So that means we're very early in the process. What she can do is pick them off by hand and discard them, but I suspect there is a population explosion coming, and we usually see that toward the second week of July, that the Japanese beetle population will just start to exponentially grow as more and more beetles emerge from the soil where they have spent the winter growing and developing and waiting since last fall. So in small numbers, hand-picking works on some valuable plants. Screening or netting that's fine enough to keep out the beetles will work. On larger plants, you can use garden insecticides, realizing that we have no insecticide that's going to stop them all with a single application. It's going to have to be repeated application. So for things like crab apples and linden trees that get defoliated, we just tolerate that, put up with it, and wait for the green leaves to return next year.
All right, endure the onslaught. Okay.
If it happens, and maybe this will be like 2013, 2014, the summer 2014, populations were very low around the state. They've been building since then, so it's up and down every year. It's a little too early to tell, but we are at the start.
Now, I'm sure this is not the last time we'll be talking about them this summer. Let's go back to the phones. Mike is on the line in Mason City. Hi, Mike.
Hey there. My question is, I moved to town a year ago, bought a house, and there were two beautiful ash trees in the front, and I know that the ash trees are being affected by a disease. They were injected a couple years ago by ArborJet, and they look pretty good still. There's dead branches on towards the bottom of the trees, and again, they're pretty good-sized trees. I have a twin sister, Mendota Heights, and she just had to remove two of the ash trees. And I know last year they hadn't hit Cerro Gordo County yet. So I'm just curious what's happening with the ash trees and the borer.
The emerald ash borer is in 71 different counties. And you're right, we have not reported it officially in Cerro Gordo County yet, but I assume your turn will come soon enough. The decision you have to make is, are these trees valuable enough to keep? Are they healthy and vigorous enough to utilize the insecticide if it's injected into them? Or should I cut my losses and replace them with something else? Or maybe I should replace one of them and inject the other one. You see, there are all these options, and it's really up to you. And the best way to make these decisions is with an on-the-ground, or actually in-the-air, inspection by an arborist who can come cut out the dead branches, tell you what's going on, evaluate the health and vigor of the tree, and then decide. You can decide, yes, I'm going to keep it, yes, I'm going to treat it, no, I'm going to replace it. All of those options are available to you, but that arborist in the tree is really an important step in this process in terms of what's going on up there, why are there dead branches, if I remove them, do I still have a good tree? Lots of questions.
All right, and no easy answers. Sorry, Mike. that's an area for a whole lot of research for a whole lot of people. All right, let's get one more question in here. Tom is on the line in Johnston. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
I've got a Marmo maple in my front yard that I planted about 13 years ago, and that's a cultivar I think they developed in Chicago to kind of replace the Dutch elms, and it's kind of like a hybrid between like a silver and a red maple, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
It doesn't have, it's a kind of a more hardy maple, I guess, but fast growing. Anyhow, I've had this issue where this spring I've noticed that even in a slight breeze, I seem to lose quite a few leaves off the tree. And I look at the leaves, and there's nothing appears to be wrong with the leaves. They're green, they're healthy. It just seems, and it's not like it's defoliating or anything, but it's just it just loses quite a bit of leaves. It seems like whenever there's a windy day, is this something I should be concerned about? Is that normal for a maple, or I guess I'm just kind of at a loss.
I wouldn't be greatly concerned. We have had some very fierce winds this spring, and I have noticed walking to work and back that there are a number of trees where the wind has simply kind of ripped off the leaves, maples and oaks and other trees. The trees themselves look fine, but when the leaves first develop, they're fairly tender, fairly succulent, and they can be ripped off fairly easily. As they mature, they become more leathery and tougher. So I'm thinking at this point, it's probably just the fact we've had some very strong wind events, and they basically ripped off some leaves.
All right. So nothing to worry
about.
Not
to worry.
That's great news. We are out of time. Richard Geron, thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
Richard Geron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. Donald Lewis, thank you.
Thank you, Charity. It's always a pleasure. Good luck with the fun drive.
Thank you. Donald Lewis, Professor of Entomology at Iowa State University. We will be back with Horticulture Day again next Friday. No fun drive next Friday on Hort Day here on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.